Lucas Barfield.
And I'm Uncle Dig.
Yeah. Welcome to the Cannabis Corner.
And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How's it going today, Uncle Dig?
It is going good. It's a beautiful day here in Southern Oregon. It is raining.
Yeah, I think it's a little rainy here, too, although we have started to kind of come out of the rain. We're getting into the spring, and we just passed the, Groundhog Day is the point in between the solstice, the winter solstice and the spring solstice. That's the halfway point. So we're kind of halfway to spring, and then it's looking to be a good spring for cannabis. I'm looking to get some clones and kind of get that going. It's been a while since we talked, Dig. A lot's been going on out there in the cannabis world, and we're going to be catching up on some of that. But how has your garden been going?
Oh, my garden's been good. I pulled a pretty good yield from my outdoor this year. I also, unfortunately, got ripped for the first time. Someone stole my last two cannabis plants this outdoor grow season. And then I'm actually in the process of flowering and harvesting some auto flowers indoors right now. I'll be trimming a little later today.
Yeah, I've been hearing about your auto flowers, and you and I actually had a little time to spend together recently, face-to-face, person-to-person. Audius, Dig is really doing some great things with cannabis these days, and if you can check out his podcast, The Bag C Chronicles, out there on all your podcast platforms, he really kind of gets into growing a little more than we do here on the Cannabis Corner, so be sure to check that out, and really happy to hear your success lately with your show, The Bag C Chronicles, Dig.
Yeah, it's going really good. I'm starting to get some bigger guests, some guests that are more known throughout the larger cannabis community, like Red Scare Seed Company. I had Brandon Rust, who's pretty big in Oklahoma, come on. I also just recently had a more local to your area, Lakewood Bay Seed Bank, a Multiverse Seed Company. The owner of that, Paul from Multiverse, came on the Bag Seed Chronicles and talked to me recently. That's the most recent episode you can hear on my feed. Come check us out. We'd love to for you to give us a listen.
Yeah, great to hear. And for the guest on today's show, we have John Kingsbury. He's going to be coming on later to talk to us about medical cannabis and bring us up to date on some bills down in Washington State. Some really interesting things going on here in Washington. Some good things and some things that are not so good since the last time we talked. But before we talk to John, let's go ahead and get into this week's news. And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa Special Report.
And for our first news story, we are going to talk about a topic that we've spoken about a lot on the Cannabis Corner, and that is these hemp-derived cannabinoids that are out there around Delta-8, THC. They also have THCO. A friend of mine in Maine just said the other day he ran out of cannabis and was needing something, and he got something called THCP, and he took a half a gummy and was like eating a whole edible. So these things are out there, and they are chemically derived from CBD, but we're going to be looking at what's going on in Florida. And just as an aside real quick, these kind of bills have this... These regulations have already come to Washington State. I served on what was called the Hemp and Food Task Force last year, and they passed a bill that regulated all these things in Washington State. I don't have the exact details, but some of these Delta-8s and these other cannabinoids are being regulated more heavily here in Washington, for good or bad. You can kind of look at it both ways. But down there in Florida, Dig, and this is where I first became aware of this. A friend of mine in Panama City was telling me that they are selling these Delta-8s and the THCOs and Ps and all this stuff just down there in, like, smoke shops and CBD stores right there,
yes,
on the beach.
That's where I first saw it.
Yeah. So you cannot buy, like, cannabis, but you could go in the store and buy this Delta-8, which will get you just as high as THC-9, but a little different. And they're just selling it in the stores and everything, and it's going all around the country, but there's kind of a movement to crack down on this.
Yeah, and it's concerning, too, because I read deeper into this article, and I looked into what's going on in Florida, and the House bill sponsor of this anti-hemp legislation, they're targeting anything that creates a euphoric effect is how they're wording that. That's incredibly broad. The bill sponsor, Tommy Gregory, R of Lakewood Ranch. I'm sure that's some sprawling nightmare suburb in Florida. He said that when they passed the hemp bill in 2019, they assumed that it would be for industrial hemp, believing the plant would be used for products such as textiles, rope, and animal feed. Instead, hemp-based products are, according to him, being taken for psychoactive purposes. Now, that is concerning because he's also burying the lead a little bit, because they're not just going to go after these. It seems like they're getting ready to push to go after smokable hemp as well down the road.
Yeah, it was a bit confusing because the Florida law, it looked like to me they were targeting more Delta 9 THC than actually these other side cannabinoids, although the other hemp-based cannabinoids are getting wrapped up in it. But what they're doing with Delta 9 is, you know, hemp legally, so you can grow this if you got a license in Florida or around, it's 0.3% THC, or is it 0.03?
Yeah. It's something like that. I think it's 0.3.
Yeah, 0.3% THC is the legal definition of hemp. Well, here's the thing. That still is THC in that plant. So you can take a whole ton of hemp and extract it and get Delta 9 THC out of it and then use that Delta 9 in these hemp-based products. And that's what they're doing along with these Delta 8s and the THC O's and P's and everything else down there in Florida, and they're looking to crack down on it. And now you can never tell, Dig, are they trying to crack down on it because these things are competing with the medical cannabis market? Are they trying to crack down on it because they want to arrest more people? Or are they trying to crack down on it because it actually is a health concern? I can never really tell what the intent is.
I kind of feel like it comes from this vague, like, I mean, this is my impression. It seems like a lot of these like really aggressive Republican lawmakers that are targeting these hemp, there is a health concern, right? Because we haven't really if you're worried about novel cannabinoids and their health effects, some of these cannabinoids are lab derived from hemp, and they're not real. They've never really been tested in any kind of trials, whereas THC and CBD have been heavily studied at this point, as well as to a lesser degree THCA and CBN. But when you have all these novel things, you start to running into like, well, this molecule is similar to THCA, but it's different enough to be considered a novel chemical. So does it have different effects? That is a concern. But I think this also comes, you see in the language of the law, like, they cause euphoria. They cause psychoactive effect. I think this comes from a more puritanical place as well. They don't want people to have fun. And I think there's also a tax incentive. If they can prove that these things are mind-altering, that means the state is not profiting off of your good time. So they have a way to skim off the top of the liquor sales. They skim off of cannabis sales. They can't increase the taxes on this stuff so they can get more money off of it. So they want to eliminate it because it's competing with their other tax bases. So they're acting like a mafia.
Yeah, it's real cynical reasons. Rarely do they do things for the health reasons. And there are health concerns about these things. Like you said, they hadn't been tested and there's some chemical processes behind it. So there have been some kids that died from some gummies that were tainted with some of these hemp-derived cannabinoids. Some of the chemicals were left over from making it. I think it was a kid in Virginia that we reported on one of the previous Cannabis Corners. So these things are toxic if they're not processed correctly. So it is interesting that they're wanting to do away with them because I think they're just it's just whack-a-mole. They're just going to keep changing the these drug laws. All they got to do is change one little molecule bond, and it makes a different drug, and they can be legal, and you can't really stop it. So we'll see what happens on Florida. We'll keep monitoring that. Our next story, we're going to move over to Ohio, and in between the last time we recorded and now, Ohio passed an adult use cannabis bill, Dig. And they've been trying to do this for a long time. Yeah, they have been trying to do this for a while. They had some kind of quirky thing in the legislature where they were like, okay, if the legislature doesn't get it done, there's going to be a vote for the people. And then the legislature somehow circumvented that law. And then they kept going around and around. And then finally, this past November, they actually had a vote of the people. And the people at Ohio overwhelmingly passed adult use cannabis. Now, one of the interesting things is that I like is they are starting from a point. Ohio already has a medical cannabis system and a decent one in some ways. In other ways, it's a little quirky, but they are going to allow the medical cannabis shops just to move over into the adult use shops. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah. It does seem like, much like Oklahoma, once they got over the initial, well, not like Oklahoma. Oklahoma's medical. Ohio's full legal. But once they passed it, they're taking a very business-friendly approach to it. So it seems like there's not quite as much red tape. They're not charging an application fee, unlike every other recreational market. Now, yeah, I found the way they're dealing with applicants' criminal history to be a little bit weird. Not even concerning, it's just an odd thing. So applicants with a first degree misdemeanor via conviction or guilty plea within 5 years of filing an application will be denied. But if they have first degree misdemeanors beyond 5 years, they won't be automatically disqualified, even if it relates to marijuana possession, marijuana trafficking, illegal cannabis cultivation, or illegal use or possession of drug or cannabis paraphernalia. So if it's been within 5 years, you can't play. But if it's been older than 5 years, you can. And to me, that seems strange. But I wonder if that's trying to target recent people who are not playing ball in the illegal market. I don't know. It's strange to me.
Yeah, I thought that was strange too, and a little heavy-handed. But I think that is Ohio's way of being socially equitable. So that's sort of their social equity program. They're acknowledging, black and other communities of color are more likely to get arrested for cannabis than white people, and that is very well-documented fact. And this is their way of saying, well, if you've been arrested for cannabis 5 years ago, then we're going to look the other way because we know that these communities have been targeted more. But I'm like you. I don't get the within 5 years thing. You don't get one at all because there's all kind of things you can get a first class misdemeanor for. So it seems like it would eliminate way more people than just people who got arrested for dealing cannabis. And I think they're saying, well, I think like you said, like, oh, cannabis has been sort of kind of legal in Ohio medically for at least 5 years. So if you haven't been playing ball with us within those 5 years, then you're just a criminal and we're not going to allow you in the system. That does seem a little strange. And it's going to backfire like it does everywhere else because those people aren't going to go away. If you're if you're growing cannabis and you want to get into adult use and you don't get into the adult use, then I feel like people are just going to go further into the underground market and it's just going to kind of exacerbate the situation a little more. So we are against those kind of things, at least I am, because we want to just open it up to everybody. We don't want these hoops to jump through to be able to own a cannabis business because it just makes it more restrictive. But I am like you. I also like that they didn't charge the application fees. Some of the states, they go crazy with the application fees. It's like they
thousands of dollars.
Oh, thousands, 50,000.
Racks and racks. I've heard $100,000 in some place. It's crazy. It's absolutely to grow hippie tomatoes. It's nuts.
Yeah, it is. So it's good on Ohio. They look like they're kind of being a little more business friendly, and hopefully they kind of, we can report next time that they're switching over to like the nuts and bolts of the law, which I didn't see much in this article about, like, is there home grow? How much cannabis can you possess? What's the concentration of extracts and all this stuff? So there are still lots of details to work out in this Ohio law, so we will keep an eye on that. Our next piece of news is we're going to jump over across the pond over here to the UK, and we're going to look at something that to many of us, it's kind of like, duh. that we already know this, and we've been telling people this for a long time. And personally, I use cannabis for sleep, not all the time, but a fair amount. And they did a study over in the UK. So in 2018 in the UK, they decided we can prescribe medical cannabis to you as long as conventional treatments don't work. And they're really strict about that. Now, they say that kind of here in the United States sometimes in some places, but they don't always, it's not always super enforced, which I'm totally fine with. I always thought the conventional treatment thing was just a way to deny people medical cannabis. But they're, in this study, they were real strict about this. And they had some interesting results come out of this study over there, Diggs. You got some details for the sleep study in the UK concerning cannabis its effectiveness.
Yeah, I do. So they had 60 patients who were enrolled in the UK Cannabis Registry. We explained how limited their cannabis program, which also explains the small sample size. Research reported that, first of all, the cannabis products were well tolerated. They assessed the efficacy of cannabis at 1, 3, and 6 months. The conclusions of the study were more than 40% of participants who completed each PROM, patient reported outcome measure, found reported clinically significant improvement in their sleep quality at each time period. These results show that the initiation of cannabis-based medicinal products therapy was associated with improvements in those patients who had previously failed to respond to current licensed treatment for insomnia. So what this says is that not only does cannabis seem to treat insomnia to a certain degree with more than 40% of patients, this is treatment resistant insomnia. Insomnia that hasn't responded to other kinds of insomnia treatments. Other studies assessing the use of cannabis products have found them to be effective from the UK for chronic pain, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, depression, migraine, and inflammatory bowel disease. So we're starting to get a body of evidence in the UK that supports what we've been finding in studies from Israel and some places in the United States. So this is good. We're starting to get a really good corpus of cannabis evidence that we can point to people who don't think cannabis is evidence-based.
Yeah, that's a really great thing because there's kind of a lot of people don't take the research going on in the United States seriously, it seems like, when it comes to cannabis, just because we've been so far ahead over here with our cannabis laws. Medical cannabis has been legal in California since 1996. And you just have this impression out there that people are like, oh, whatever, you know, this is just a bunch of dopers getting high. And a lot of the studies, you can show it to lawmakers, you can show it to people, but they just kind of roll their eyes like, yeah, right. But when we start getting other countries, more and more of these studies, it just opens up the door more. And then we'll cover this next show, but they're possibly going to deschedule cannabis here in the United States coming up soon, or not deschedule it, but change the schedule from a schedule 1 to a schedule 3. But studies like this are going to help with that change. Now, we wanted to go further than that, but nevertheless, these kind of studies will help open up cannabis to more people, more places, and they carry a little more weight than I think some of these studies that go on in the United States.
We've got some cool news coming out of Germany that might be happening next, pretty soon.
Yeah, so we're going to get on to our next story, and that is Germany. This has been going on for a long time. We have reported on this for probably over a year and a half, 2 years. I remember the first story I wrote for Ganjapreneurs on Germany possibly going to an adult use market. They do have the medical cannabis. They have the largest medical cannabis market in the European Union, and they are expected to have the largest adult use cannabis market in the European Union once they go adult use. And they have decided to go ahead and put that on the agenda for the finance committee, and they are getting that moving. And the member of the hemp group over there, Activism for Hemp, they said that now that this is on the agenda, that it's very unlikely for them to stop and reverse this move.
Right, but I would remind folks that the Germans are very methodical and very slow, it seems, in their legislative process. So right now, Right now, what they're doing is legalizing it for Germans through social clubs and home cultivation. If people aren't familiar with social clubs, it's basically you can't just go buy cannabis. You have to go pay a private club fee, and you consume it at the club, or you get it at the club and take it home, if that makes sense. It's an older way of distributing cannabis and keeping it within the citizens of that country. Currently, they're not looking at becoming a tourist destination. However, through the next couple of coming years, they're looking at setting up more like retail sales of cannabis will be further down the road legislatively. And I think we can look at that more in like a year or 2 year time frame. So I wouldn't look for Germany to become a tourist destination for cannabis in the short term, but mainly just for a slight increase in access for native Germans. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I really like the social club model. It's the model they have in Spain. I think Uruguay, when you hear that Uruguay passed as the first country in the world to legalize adult use cannabis, that's how they distribute it there. And it's the model that basically the medical cannabis system here in Washington State and other places were sort of based off of. Now, it didn't always operate exactly like this, but, you know, if you have 40 people in the if you have 40 people in your social club and everybody smokes an ounce a month, then the club would grow 40 to 45 ounces a month. Now, you multiply right. that on up. You know, let's say they grow 2 ounces and they grow 80 ounces. And so then everybody right. comes to the club and gets their how much they've committed to help grow. It's kind of like a co-op. You know, it's like a cannabis
yeah,
co-op.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if Germany, how close they're going to stick to that model, but it'd be good if, I mean, I'm totally okay with that. And I think, like you said, I think this is good for countries like the UK, because over in the UK, I've heard people are not super thrilled with the United States retail model for cannabis. They don't like the business-centered part of it. So I think that this thing going on in Germany will be sort of a model that we'll see roll out in other countries that aren't quite like the people are really into cannabis in the UK and Europe, but the government and the state is a little more conservative when it comes to these kinds of things, and it seems like they are here in the United States. And that's for a lot of different reasons, but
one of those reasons is the United States war on drugs. We exported some of our worst drug policies abroad.
Yeah, back when they were signing all those conventions back in the 19-teens and the 1930s and everything, and even now, one of our things is like we won't sign on to this drug law because it goes against the United Nations drug law. So even now, and I think Australia, we've looked at this before on the show, they passed a Cannabis Stamp Act the same time we did. So there are countries right. around the world that you can follow the exact same track as the United States did on this whole thing. And in the other places, it seems like these laws have stuck a little longer than they have here, thankfully. But maybe we should try to get an expert on this one day and talk some more about this worldwide war on drugs that started in the late 1890s that you can basically track to the pharmaceutical industry. And then later on, famously, Jack Harry, you can track to the pulp and paper and oil companies started cracking down on hemp. But the first attack on cannabis and hemp came from the pharmaceutical companies and aspirin is the whole thing. So that all started in the 1890s, but you can just track it around the world. It's very fascinating. But it's good on Germany to start slowly rolling this back.
Yeah, I'm excited to one day maybe, you know, have a German vacation. I don't know. I've always wanted to go to Europe, but I've been on an air base in Germany when I was in the military, but I didn't really get to leave. I was there for a very short time, and then I had to catch a plane. But I've always wanted to go and explore, but I would wonder if cannabis was legal.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what German cannabis is like. I have an interesting story about Germany. I worked at the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. I was associated with that, worked for the university, but I was around there. Dig, the Germans brought their entire Olympic village. They brought it to the United States, shipped over an entire house, and built it right there the campus for the Olympics. And then when they left, they just took a lot of it with it, but they just left a lot of it here too. It was just interesting to see that this whole, I think people think it's a stereotype of how methodical and the Germans are, but I really think as a people, they really are very methodical, and they really do things the German way, you know. So I'm interested to see what kind of cannabis they grow.
I think after the first couple of years, it's going to be very, very good.
Yeah, I think so too.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
And we are back for this week's interview. And this week we have a very special guest, and he is somebody who has been on the Cannabis Corner before, a couple years back in the season 3, I think John was on. And we are happy to welcome back to the show John Kingsbury.
Thank you.
Yeah, and John is going to be here today to talk to us about some things going on locally here in Washington State when it comes to medical cannabis. And he has been an activist for a while in the cannabis space here in Washington State. But I want to jump right into this, John. Just take a second to introduce yourself and tell us how you got into medical cannabis activism here in the state of Washington.
Well, my name is John Kingsbury. I am a medical cannabis patient, which certainly drives my activism. And just to be brief, I think three things led me into my activism. First was becoming a patient in 2009. I received an authorization from a neurologist, and the first thing I noticed is that my pills, my other medications, were dropping, and those were sort of borrowing from my quality of life. So that was the first thing, was my recognition that of the real impact that medical cannabis can have on quality of life. The second thing that I think really caused me to become more of an activist was Bill Kurtz. And just to summarize briefly, Bill Kurtz was a patient who had some profound physical problems, and he had been growing in his garage, and someone called the police on him. And Bill Kurtz was in court for almost 3 years, and I was asked to be on court watch. And what court watch is you just go and you sit in the courtroom, and it's just a way of letting the court know that the defendant has advocates and that people are watching. And for nearly 3 years, I watched the Thurston County prosecutor and the state of Washington drag Bill Kurtz, who had undeniable conditions. He had 5 letters from 5 doctors, and they wanted to, they ended up convicting him of illegal cultivation, they dragged him through court for 3 years. And what Bill Kurtz did was he found a lawyer, or he had a lawyer found for him, that took him to the Supreme Court. And his argument was that he should be able to plead medical necessity, which he hadn't been able to do in the original trial. I watched all the harm that they caused that man. He had 5 heart attacks during that process. He'd never had a heart attack before, and made his life a hell for no particular public safety reason that I could see. And it made me so angry that was the second thing that really caused me to be an activist. And when I walked away from that experience, and we were in 2014 or 2015, and we were starting to talk about the so-called Cannabis Patients Protection Act, the one thing that I noticed is that legislators and lobbyists and advocates were talking about patients as though we were just basically criminals on a scam, and still feeling a little raw from having watched Bill Kurtz go through his process. I realized that when they were talking that way, they were talking about me. And I realized that I needed to become politically active at that point. So really those three things are how my activism started.
Yeah, that was great, and I really appreciate you sharing there. And that 2015 episode is what got me going in cannabis activism. Is I saw the impact the police had on the cannabis community growing up in Alabama and traveling around the country. And then when I came out here to Washington State and got a medical cannabis card and was able to go in the store and be able to purchase clean and look to be safe cannabis, not on the streets or having to wait for somebody at a phone booth or dodge the police or sneak around. That was just an amazing experience for me as a medical cannabis patient. And then in 2015, the state decided they were going to take that away. So I kind of, like you, was like, oh, wow. I just could not believe some of the vehemence and the language come out of Olympia when it came to medical cannabis, because I saw it all coming in the newspapers. You could see how the state was kind of going back in 2014 when they were wanting to shut down all the medical cannabis shops. So I think that is where we first met back then, as in that 2015 fight, which led to the Cannabis Patient Protection Act, and then now we have the recreational cannabis. So we're going to move on to the next question, and that is, I wanted to get a definition from you from I want to get a definition from you on exactly what medical cannabis is, because I get the impression, and you hear from other people, which is, well, we have recreational cannabis where you can go in and buy it at the store. So what else do you sick people and disabled people want? So as someone who's been involved in this for a while, and you had the story there, Bill, and you've been on the ground, what is a good definition to you of medical cannabis?
Well, the definition I use is cannabis use to treat the symptoms of a qualifying condition or a condition that has been diagnosed by a doctor who's treating you and has recommended that you try cannabis if it isn't on the list of qualifying conditions. So it's basically cannabis use specifically for the purpose of treating a qualifying condition. Just as contrast, sometimes I hear something, and this is a personal pet peeve of mine, people say all use is medical use. And when I hear that, I go a little bit nuts, because I do not think what you're talking about in that case for many people is, you can, if I go into a bar on Friday and I order a drink and they say, oh, well, you know, they're making small talk, I'll just say, well, this drink is about medical use, which is just another way of saying I'm drinking this to relax. And so when I hear people say all use is medical use, what I feel is that they're comparing using cannabis, say, to relax or wind down, as compared to somebody that's treating it for multiple sclerosis or some situation that's really hampering their life. So I personally have difficulty with that view of medical cannabis, that all use is medical. And so that's why I have a much tighter definition than some people have.
Yeah, and I've heard that too, the all use is medical argument, and it sort of doesn't get to the exact point of medical use, which is, for somebody with a profound disability, is a little more than winding down. It's actually being able to wake up and get through your day without being laid up in bed, or being able to get through your day and be able to be functional. So I wanted to check in real quick.
Right.
As somebody who's been again in the state legislature for a while on this, what's the status of medical cannabis right now in Washington State?
Well, so part of that is a question of access. And I think that's the lens to look through. So in 2015, as you mentioned, the Cannabis Patient Protection Act established, they basically said, we're going to recriminalize patients, we're going to put a lot of restrictions on you, but in exchange, we're going to make these provisions in the law. And so that's the lens that I look through when you ask the question, what is the state of medical cannabis? So those promises were, you'll have consultants in stores who will help guide people through medical cannabis, because it is a sort of a higher level of use in a way. It is more complex, and most people don't know. And then another commitment they made was you'll have products that are of higher quality. They're more appropriate for medical use as opposed to recreational use. Another promise that was made was that we would have stores that had endorsements where you could go get services that were designed to accommodate medical use. And when I look at this objectively, and I also look at the participation rate in the state registry, which I'm not big on, but is an indicator of some things, I would say that it would be difficult to argue that Washington State has a medical cannabis system at all. So that's pretty pessimistic, but that's my view of it based on the markers that I just described.
So speaking of consultants and stores, we went through a process last year, or probably was in late 2022, and we were doing some updates to the medical cannabis consultant rules at the DOH, or the Department of Health, and some other things when it came to medical cannabis and how these stores are regulated. Could you take a second to talk about what the DOH did recently to update the medical cannabis rules?
The Department of Health is in charge of licensing and monitoring and training standards for medical cannabis consultants, who are those store staff in endorsed stores who are supposed to deal with patients or supposed to have some training to deal with patients. That took a very long time. From the time they accepted my petition for rulemaking until it was completed, it was a period of 4 years. I think there were some good things that were done, and I think there were some missed opportunities. So in the good things that were done, they really got a lot more specific about what consultants would have to learn as far as being helpful to patients. How can they help them? Prior to that, I think the emphasis was more on what can't they tell patients. So, for example, they can't diagnose a condition, or they can't say this will treat this. The emphasis was really on all the things that consultants couldn't do, but not very much on what they could do. So I think the really positive benefit of the consultant rulemaking that was finished was that it talked more about the things they could talk about, like methods of administration, like terpenes, like, you know, how can they positively help patients? So I think that was good. Where I think there were a couple of really important opportunities that were missed is one thing that I wanted to see and really fought for was I see patients who end up in trouble with the law because they don't understand what the law is. They were trying to comply. They thought they were complying. And next thing they know, and these are people already that have a lot of challenges in their lives, suddenly they're wrapped up in a court system. And I can give you some specific examples of how patients really got into trouble. But one thing I really fought for in that rulemaking is that consultants, if they registered a patient or they were interacting with a patient, they should provide them with some basic legal information. For example, if you're registering a patient, they need to say to them, you can have 6 plants. You, no matter how many patients you have in a house, you can only have 15 plants max. Things like that, just to keep patients out of trouble. And DOH didn't buy that. I think a lot of that is because that process was monitored by behavioral health people, drug recovery people, and they didn't see it as important. So I think those were missed opportunities, but I think the enhancements in training were really useful.
So you mentioned endorsements a couple times. So these are basically a special license the state gives out to these stores. So if somebody shows up, first of all, where can people find out where these stores are? And if right now, I know you said medical cannabis is not being enforced and non-existent in the state, but these stores should have things going on. It's just not being enforced at the moment that very well. If somebody was to find one of these stores and show up to an endorsed store, what sort of services should they expect right now?
So what the stores ought to be able to do is set by state, is set by statute, meaning the legislature said these stores need to provide these services. And this, whether or not they do, and monitoring that is part of the Liquor and Cannabis Board, which has not traditionally been tasked with providing medical care. They tend to look at things more like policemen. But what you should be able to expect from a store that holds an endorsement is they need to be able to enter patients into the patient database if the patient chooses to go to that route, and they ought to be able to issue recognition cards. They ought to be able, they're supposed to stock some amount of medical grade cannabis product in the store, which is something that hardly ever happens. They should be able to talk to patients about methods of administration and different strains and that sort of thing. They ought to be able to tell patients, okay, you've brought me this authorization from your doctor. You get from this. These are the plant limits you should be able to have. They should be able to basically explain the basic law to the patient. So those are some of the basic things that are set in law. They need to have a consultant in the store that can perform all of those functions. I do recommend that if somebody's trying to find an endorsed store, a Department of Health has a list, LCB has a list. These lists are wildly inaccurate. So what any patient or potential patient wants to do is they want to call first, see if the consultant is in, see if they actually do provide the services, even though they hold an endorsement and they're on a list, there's a high probability that maybe they're not really performing those functions. So they want to call before they just walk into a store, unless they're going into the store anyway.
I wanted to talk about real quick, you were saying that some patients had gotten in trouble when it comes to some of these laws. And I've experienced this a lot, where you meet patients around the state, but they don't know the rules, or they think right. They know the rules, and they're really convinced that they know the rules. I kind of quit trying to convince people otherwise
exactly
that they didn't know what they were talking about, because they're like, oh, no, you don't know. And so I'm like, well, I guess if you want to do this wrong, then that's on you. But
yeah, and it's really a problem, because when you take people who are patients, they have a lot of life challenges right out of the gate, right? They have some sort of physical challenges. It is very, very common, maybe the norm, that when you have chronic medical conditions, you tend to have financial issues because you tend to be under earning, or your medical expenses are high, or both. And so you have a lot of challenges there. And so you take people like that, and then you throw them into the court system to, you know, you may have a police force or a prosecutor or a judge or all of the above who aren't really sympathetic to the benefits of medical cannabis, or they're skeptical of medical cannabis at all. And so you take a person with a lot of challenges already in their life that they're trying to manage, and you throw them into that. And there's a particular level of cruelty, I think, to it. And that was why, when I was asking for consultant training, that consultants would be more or less required to sort of explain basic things like, this is your authorization. Your authorization says you can have this many plants and no more, or you can hold this much product and no more, or no matter how many patients are in your house, you can only have 15 plants in your house, which was one place where a lot of people got arrested, and they just got blindsided. I can't tell you how many calls where I've received calls from people who are just like, I never saw this coming. What's the law? What's this and that? And you know, it's really, really unnecessary that ever had to happen. A really common problem that I saw a lot was you'd have a couple, and each person would have gotten their registered. They had authorizations that said you can have 15 plants. The wife had an authorization that said you could have 15 plants. They went to the store. They found a store. They got authorized. They entered the database, which is pretty uncommon in the state to be registered. And so they thought they were covered, and they went to all these, all these levels, all these efforts to do what they thought they were supposed to do. And then, somebody smelled something, or somebody reported, or for whatever reason, police show up at their door and they've got 30 plants, and they're like, yeah, here's our paperwork, here's all that. And next thing they know, the police are ripping down their house, taking out their garden and their equipment, and then they're in the court system, and they never ever saw it coming. And that is something that other patients don't face. When I go and I fill an oxycodone prescription and I walk out of the store, that's assumed to be legal activity. And usually my doctor says something about what the rules are, and my pharmacist says something about what the rules are. So there's really low level risk unless I swallow a handful and go drive or something, which I don't need somebody to tell me not to do, right? And there's not that level of clarity and education with cannabis and cannabis patients, which is something that I think that we really need to work on. So that's me on my little soapbox. And the only reason I'm so passionate about that is because I have had so many nights where I'm on the phone with some family or some person that's very upset because they just got hit by a train that they just never saw coming, and they thought they were doing everything right. That's something I've been passionate about. That's why I worked on the arrest protection bill. I just think that we can do better by our cannabis patients as a state.
The Washington state has the highest excise tax on cannabis in the country. It's 37%. And then the reason why that they put the tax on there, for a variety of reasons, and we've talked about this on the Cannabis Corner before, is very cynical reason. Back in 2015, they wanted to make sure that cannabis patients weren't going in and buying like 4 ounces of cannabis at a regular price or at a discounted price and then taking it out and selling it. So I remember that in the legislature, that was one of the reasons they slapped this 37% tax on there, to make it not financially viable for basically medical cannabis patients with disabilities. Now, this is in their own head, to be out there dealing cannabis out there on the corner because they got cheap cannabis in the medical cannabis system. So they put this 37% tax on there. But as we know, that's not the case. Patients aren't out there selling drugs, and they're not out there financially benefiting off cannabis. They actually have a bill that's going to remove that 37%. How do you think this will benefit patients, and how close are we to getting this passed?
So I think one of the consequences of not keeping the commitments that were made to patients in 2015 and of the continued challenges that patients have in the regulated market is that there is still a pretty substantial illicit medical market. We can't get what we need at the prices that are in the store. So I think one thing that'll happen, so the proposal is this. One, to remove the 37% excise tax on medical grade product, not anything in the store, for patients who are willing to enter the registry. And there's a lot of facets to this. One of the facets is that as an indicator of the health or the illness of the medical cannabis system in Washington, almost no patients register in the state, especially compared to other states. So an example of that would be in Colorado, they have about 80,000 patients in their registry. And they also have a recreational home growing provision, which in theory should keep their registration rate lower. In Washington state, 9,500 patients thereabouts are in the registry. We don't know exactly how many are in the registry, which is bizarre to me, and we're the only state that can't just look up how many patients are registered. But we have about a tenth of the patients as Colorado in total numbers, but we also have 2 million more citizens, which is an indicator of how little engagement patients have with the regulated cannabis system. We were promised medical grade product, but LCB just decided they weren't going to enforce that rules for stores that hold endorsements. The end result is that you almost can't find that product. Producers don't want to produce it because it's more expensive. So even for patients that can afford it, they generally can't find it. So what this would do is it would, this excise tax would take product, medical grade product, which patients say they're lacking, they can't, you know, again, patients tend to be poorer, and it would bring that product more closer to where patients can afford it. That would incentivize us to engage with the regulated system. It would incentivize patients to enter the registry. It would incentivize producers to produce the product because they go, oh, suddenly there's a market for this. It would educate stores that this product exists, even though medically endorsed stores are supposed to stock this product. It is the norm more than it is the exception that endorsed stores and medical consultants don't even know what compliant product is. So it would incentivize stores to learn about this product and stock it. So it would do all kinds of things like that. But the big deal, the overarching value, is that it would take this higher grade product that patients say they need, and it would make it more affordable for patients. So we can go into a store, get what we need, which is how it should be anyway. The quality of product and the types of products for patients, people that are really using this for medical uses, are really hard to find in the regulated store. And so it would take all of these deficiencies in the systems for patients and sort of address a lot of them. It wouldn't cure all the problems, but really address a variety of deficiencies all at once with one initiative. And I just don't. I think the prospects for this are very, very good. And so I'm really optimistic that this will be one of the single most important things in terms of legislative efforts as far as actually creating a system that's friendly and beneficial to patients.
Yeah, I really think that would be a great bill if it passes. It does account the fact that many people on medical cannabis are on disability and lower income. So taking away that 37% will give access to people on disability or people who have less income. It'll give them the same access to a high quality product as somebody with like a full-time job that can just go into the store and afford some of them higher grade, better products out there. So this is a really great bill, and I really hope it passes this year. Besides medical cannabis, though, you have been one of the people that have been pushing our home grow bill. Now, this was a bill that let everybody grow plants who are over 21. Anybody over 21 be able to grow at home. Now, the numbers keep going back and forth to different numbers. It has stalled again this year. I'm hoping this thing will get passed. I do feel like we're getting closer and closer every year. It was a short session, but it did stall. So, besides just the nuts and bolts of the home grow bill, which we've talked about before on the show plenty, what is something that you have learned about working down in Olympia about Washington state politics when it comes to passing bills after working on this home grow bill for several years?
Well, that's a big question. What have I learned? One thing I've learned is that legislators have far too many complicated subjects to learn about and to understand compared to the time and attention that they have. So a lot of the job is to try and educate legislators about complicated things in short sound bites and pictures. And so as far as being an effective advocate, that's one of the skills that I'm always trying to develop and that I think people need to develop to be an effective advocate. The other thing I've learned is that you need to talk to legislators and their aides like real people. You can't go in and yell at them. You can't go even when you really want to and they really need to be yelled at. You need to you need to talk to them one-on-one and make your issue a human issue. You need to learn the mechanics of how things work. I think of legislation more like a football game than, say, a race with an end, you know, an end after a certain point. You have different committees. You'd have different personalities of different legislators. You've got different things that may get your bill attention or not get it attention. And each step of the process sort of has to be played like its own football play, for example. And that's another thing I've learned. A really important thing I've learned in human relations is that legislators vary widely and you have to meet them where they're at. Some legislators are very ideological, and some legislators, you can tell when you talk to them, they're working the problem. They're saying, okay, what's the problem and what will this look like if we do this? They're very analytical and they're more centered on problem solving than on ideological tendencies. So you have to work the whole range of those people. So let me give you an example of how this might work. I can go in and I can say to a legislator, look, we're 23 states have home grow provisions. There's 25 states that have legal recreational use and possession. 23 of those states allow a certain amount of adults to grow a few plants at home, basically because they're adults and that's not a threat to anybody. And here's what we know about the sales rates, and here's what we know about the crime rates. And you're basically presenting an analytical picture based on numbers to them. You may go into another legislator's office, and I'll tell you, I run into this with ideological Republicans often. And what they say to me is, I have no interest in cannabis. But what I often try to, where I often try to meet them is I'll say, right, but this is just about individual liberty. This is about the government telling us, not telling people what to do and trusting individuals. And you can get allies that way, even out of ideological legislators who aren't that interested in cannabis, but they are interested in the government not telling people how to live their lives. And if that's where I have to meet them, then that's where I'll take them. So the range of personalities and motivations is something that's always a task for me, right? It's always something I try to do better, but it's an important skill to have as well.
I know you've been collecting samples around the state of various cannabis products and getting them tested. You want to talk about some of the results you've been finding?
Yes, I can do that. What do you want to know?
Is there anything you're finding that is concerning out there when it comes to some of these tests you're finding? And is there any surprises?
Okay. Yeah, so this is a big subject. So just for the history of this, Washington State was the last state, even though we were the first to legalize or decriminalize, we were the last state to have mandatory pesticide testing. And prior to that pesticide testing, what I discovered was that concentrates were really sketchy in the regulated and in the unregulated markets. However, prior to having mandatory pesticide standards, what I found, which was interesting to me, since there was no checking, is that if you went to, say, the farmer's market or you were buying illicit product, the flour was always cleaner than what was in the regulated market. And I have some theories about why this must be, but I found that to be interesting. So what happened after mandatory pesticide testing is illicit flour is still cleaner than in the regulated market, but the concentrates in the regulated market have really cleaned up. And it's impressive how much better they've gotten now that people are checking. I still wouldn't buy concentrates from the illicit market unless I really knew who was making them at this point. So that those are two big trends and changes to be aware of.
If you could do one thing to reform cannabis here in the state of Washington, what would it be?
Well, I can name two things. For people that don't want to grow for themselves, that excise tax break really is going to make or break the system. I think that's the single thing that we can do that would cause the most positive change. That excise tax bill, which is 1453, by the way, which is in the Senate, so contact your senator, is the single biggest thing because it does all those things. It incentivizes producers. It will incentivize stores to stock the product. It will cause store staff to become educated about what it is, and it will bring the price closer to where patients can afford it. So they can actually go into a store and buy product that is appropriately more for medical use and cleaner. And I think about how when the state borders come down, you know, everybody thinks they're going to export and have all these big markets. But, you know, if every state is doing that, it's not going to be as gravy a situation as a lot of people think. And Washington State, I think, needs to up its game. And part of upping its game is going to have to be improving quality. So it will help contribute to the recreational market and prepare us for interstate commerce. That's sort of a weird tangent, but I believe that's true. And then the other thing I think is really will help patients, even though it's for everybody, will be home grow. And here's the reason. The legal entanglements that patients have with the current system are completely unjustifiable. They're full of hazards. Again, we talked about patients getting into the trouble with the law when they thought they were doing everything right. And I think if patients can just grow a few plants at home, those who choose to, those who can, those who have the money to, or if I want to grow for another patient and I have the ability to, without those legal entanglements, with all those paperwork requirements, then I just think that would be a huge boom to the patient community. We need to get police out of our houses, and I think we particularly need to get police out of patients' houses because life is hard enough without that. So I think home grow, even though it is for any adult, would be for any adult, would just be a huge boon in safety and access for patients. So those two things.
Yeah, thanks. And I think that police part is one of the reasons that the home grow bill always is struggling, because every time it's trying to be passed, the police do show up and say, no, don't do this. So they are not in favor of not being able to go in your house anytime they feel like it. We really appreciate all your insights into all this, John. If people wanted to get in touch with you or even wanted to get involved in some of the issues that you are passionate about and have been working on, how can people get in touch with you or find out more about your work?
So there's two ways. You can email me directly at homegrow, one word, 2018, @gmail.com. That is an indicator of how long we've been working on homegrow bills. Homegrow2018 @gmail.com. You can write to me there. I'm also heavily allied with the Cannabis Alliance. So if you go to their website or contact them, they can put you in contact with me, and I will respond to any emails I get. I have quite an extensive email list and a number of contacts. And whether you have an idea or you just want to learn about a particular subject and you don't know where to turn, or you want to start getting active, you know, write to me and I'll try and point you in the right direction or give you any resources I have. Because, you know, big business doesn't necessarily want everybody to have freedom, and, you know, they want to sell you their product. And sometimes a certain amount of prohibition will help them. And I am for any adult who wants to grow, who can grow, to be able to grow. I want patients to have less law enforcement and less courts in their and more help in their lives. And so those are the things that I'm working for. And if those are things you're working for, you know, and you would like some help or direction or want to give some input, reach out to me. I'll welcome it.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
So now we're going to get on to our last segment of the show, and I'd really like to thank John Kingsbury for being on the show with us, and that is to our It's a Bus segment. And this is going to keep us over there on the European continent, and something that happened over in Sweden to a famous actor, and his name is Bill Skarsgård, and he was arrested for less than an eighth of cannabis over there in Sweden. And Dig, I was shocked at the penalty, because we're always made to believe over in the United States, oh, Sweden and Switzerland, Europe, they're all socialists. We're made to believe that they're way more liberal in Europe about some things. How much did this guy, Bill Skarsgård, who's a famous actor, how much did he get fined over there in Sweden for less than an eighth of cannabis, Dig?
For 2.43 grams of cannabis that he had in his possession, he was charged a fine of 40,000 Swedish krona, which in U.S. dollars is $3,825. Thankfully, he won't be facing jail time, probation, or parole, but he is going to have to pay almost $4,000 in a fine.
Wow, just a super high fine there for just a very tiny amount of cannabis. And I think Sweden has some type of medical cannabis system, but I have not heard anything about Sweden going any kind of adult use. And that's where we're going to be talking about. Yeah. Germany will kind of start opening up that kind of stuff. So very interesting story coming out of Sweden. Some of the more strict laws I've ever heard about cannabis right there. So that is our show for today. I would really like to thank you, Dig, for getting back on here with us on the Cannabis Corner. And I'd like to encourage the audience to go out and check out the Backseat Chronicles out on your favorite podcast platforms. And thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank John Kingsbury again for being on the show today. And we will catch you guys next time. Thanks for being here, Dig.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Have a good time, guys.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Foles for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.